You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the May 2024 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. Here's the continuation of In Vitro Veritas by Keziah Weir, with illustrations by Mark Smith. Next illustration shows the Pope with the Vatican Dome in the background, and he's conferring with a man wearing a suit. Conception, immaculate and otherwise, was much on Pius XII's mind in the final years of his life. The Second World Congress on Fertility and Sterility, for which Lundenfeld's own Professor de Witteville was one of 12 committee members, convened in Naples on May 18, 1956, for a 9-day summit. Some 180 paper presentations, excursions to Amalfi and Pompeii, parties and fashion shows to entertain the ladies, and a special pilgrimage to Rome for an address from the Pope. It is entirely true that your zeal to pursue research on marital infertility and the means to overcome it, Pius XII told his listeners. As translated from the original Latin by Ronald L. Conte, Jr., engages high spiritual and ethical values, which should be taken into account. He also said, as regards artificial fertilization, not only is there need to be extremely reserved, but it must be absolutely excluded. A year later, Lundenfeld sat with Giulio Pacelli and Piero Donini, musing over the design needs of the special toilets they planned to install in the convent. They settled on a teardrop-shaped container akin to a small trash can lined with a plastic bag. Throughout 1958, elderly nuns hiked up their habits, crouched over the containers, and voided their bladders. Serono employees collected the bags of urine and transported them to the Rome laboratory at Via Casilini, where technicians emptied them into metal tanks for processing. During a 1930s Netherlands-based urine collection program, the people tasked with picking up donations were called pismenikis, or small pismen. By 1959, Serono had harvested enough HMG to begin trials on infertile women. Lundenfeld, back in Israel, where he was working as a visiting scientist at the Weizmann Institute of Science, wanted to treat his own hypothalamic amenorrheic patients with the drug, hoping to induce ovulation. The head of the hospital instructed Lundenfeld to inject himself with the substance. If he didn't sustain any major side effects, they'd go forward with treatment. Lundenfeld wasn't particularly worried about what it might do to his own reproductive health. For one thing, he says, I already had a son. After the first injection, which an intern administered, Lundenfeld ran a high temperature, an effect of protein buildup in the solution. He and Donini increased purification methods, and Lundenfeld continued to test and burn. On the fifth attempt, they were in the clear. Lundenfeld never patented his findings, which could have made him a very rich man. He says his greatest compensation was the ability to bring the research material and lab equipment to Israel, a gift from Serono. For a short time there, he ran a urine collection program at local elderly care centers, where postmenopausal Israeli women occupied themselves by making baby clothes for the future children their urine would ideally help conceive. In 1962, the first previously amenorrheic infertile women treated with HMG gave birth to a healthy baby. two more women became pregnant, though they later miscarried. Still, this was an enormous success, and the Israeli pharmaceutical company Teva Pharmaceutical Industries, today worth $16 billion, working in conjunction with Serono, registered the compound as Pergonol. That year, Lonenfeld became the head of the Institute of Endocrinology at Tel HaShomer Hospital, now called Sheba Medical Center. Under his direction, the program grew exponentially, and the institution became a World Health Organization International Reference Center for fertility-promoting drugs. One former research assistant, Danny Lieberman, who performed data science in Lonenfeld's lab in the mid-1970s, describes him as a paper machine whose 20-person team published something like 100 research papers in a single year. The entire physics department, by contrast, might produce five. But what particularly distinguished Lonenfeld, Lieberman remembers, was his broad, inquisitive interest in how science functioned within real human lives. He once happened upon the non-observant Lonenfeld, kippah on head, poring over the Torah. Lonenfeld had been attending weekly study sessions with a rabbi in the hopes that he might learn how to better treat the some 20% of his patients who observe the halakha, which places constraints on sexual relations according to monthly menstrual cycles. "I am sad about the suicide which Israel is committing," Lonenfeld says today. During his conscription in the Israeli army, he served under Yitzhak Rabin, who would first become prime minister in 1974. The two remained friends. When a far-right extremist who opposed Rabin's signing of the Oslo Accords assassinated the prime minister following what was widely seen as a peace rally, "For me, this was the end of Israel," Lonenfeld says. "It was not what I fought for." The United States granted Lonenfeld a green card in 2001, and for much of the year he resides in Florida, returning to Tel Aviv to visit his children and grandchildren who still live there. His eldest son, Eitan, is the head of the IVF unit at the teaching hospital for Ben-Gurion University of the Negev. The Lonenfelds are part of a long lineage of fertility specialists in Israel, where the birth rate remains substantially higher than that of other industrialized countries. "Milk and honey, technologies of plenty in the making of a holy land," 2023, by Israel-born Tamar Novik, a visiting scholar at the Humboldt University of Berlin, traces a decades-long Judeo-Christian effort to promote fruitfulness in an unfamiliar climate. From Alsatian Christian missionary beekeepers to dairy farmers during the British Mandate to Israeli scientists, including Lonenfeld, alongside the ways in which the knowledge and practices of the Palestinian people shaped European governance and settlement in the region. Novik has a fascination with the science of excrement, plus a wry sense of humor. "Taking the Piss" and "Deep Shit" are the titles of two recent presentations. Her current project is entitled Fountain of Knowledge: How Science Turned Urine into Gold. In Milk and Honey, Novik writes that with the Industrial Revolution, technology did not replace religion as a colonial device, but instead was blended with aspirations to salvage the land, becoming crucial for seizing control over lands and people. Religion, science, and politics intertwined. "Reproduction is such a fertile ground to think about this merging," she tells me. "Those three elements are always at play." Death and taxes. During the fall of 1958, a depleted Pius XII retired to the papal villa at Castel Gandolfo, the Holy See's 135-acre summer palace situated high in the hills above Lake Albano, just southeast of Rome. In the palace courtyard, uniformed school children gathered to pray, and a knot of reporters set upon the few figures allowed in and out of the residence. On October 9th, while lying in his single brass frame bed, Pius took his final breaths. A small crowd of people was present in the Pope's bedroom when he died, reported the Catholic Standard and Times the next day. Among them were Princes Carlo, Marcantonio, and Giulio. The death of a pope is always an upheaval, but in recent decades, perhaps for none more personally than the three nephews, who learned firsthand the mortality of blood ties. Within months, according to one of several articles published by Der Spiegel that year regarding Vatican finances, the commander of the Noble Guard suggested that the Pacelli brothers take a hiatus from their duties within the unit, and the boards of multiple companies requested their resignations. While abrupt, this was merely the apotheosis of public frustration that had been long brewing around the financial advantages afforded the three men through their relationship to the Pope. And Giulio Pacelli was at the center of the ire, which dated back to his 1946 appointment as papal envoy and plenipotentiary minister of Costa Rica. The following year, the government had taken aim at tax evasion, with an article in the Italian Constitution of 1947 decreeing that all shall contribute to public expenditure in accordance with their means. Pacelli, an Italian citizen, nonetheless hoped to make use of a technicality that exempted diplomatic representatives of foreign powers living in Italy from the tax. Members of the Vatican State Secretariat obligingly agreed. The Italian government did not. For nearly a decade, Rome and the Vatican argued the issue, during which time Pacelli's fortune grew. In 1955, the Christian Democratic Party Minister of Finance broke with precedent and popular opinion, officially granting Pacelli immunity. But by the spring of 1958, as the nuns diligently urinated, political parties had begun wielding the issue as anti-clerical ammunition. "The Pope's nephews don't pay their taxes," read the headline of L'Espresso, a left-wing weekly. Later that summer, the same magazine published a list of 11 Catholic laymen who managed the substantial spending power of the Vatican, which included the three Pacellis. Together, the brothers held positions on some 50 supervisory boards, and their personal combined net worth had dilated to an estimated 18 billion lire, 10 billion of which Giulio held primarily in foreign investments, the equivalent of about $170 million today. To many, Pius XII's death marked the beginning of a shift at the Vatican. His successor, John XXIII, convened the Second Ecumenical Council of the Vatican, or Vatican II, which made a crack in the inscrutability of the Church, and coincided with a mass exodus of women religious. According to Der Spiegel, after learning that certain banks and industrial plants had made overtures to some of his family members in northern Italy, he forbade his rural relatives from accepting supervisory board positions during his tenure, in response, perhaps, to the complications caused by the Pacelli brothers. Vatican II heralded larger financial changes. Back in 1942, Pius XII had created the Istituto per le Opere delle Religioni, or IOR, to serve as the Vatican's financial stronghold, the profits of which, under the Lateran Treaty, were exempt from Italian taxation. A decade later, according to Lunenfeld, the Vatican acquired a 25% stake in Istituto Farmacologico Serono. In 1968, Italy's Parliament voted to resume taxing dividends on stocks held by the Vatican. Consequently, the Vatican decided it would be prudent to relieve itself of some of its major investments. The IOR turned to Michele Sindona, a financier with ties to both Hollywood and the mob, who for years had been insinuating himself into Vatican financial affairs, acquiring banks and holding companies in which the IOR retained significant stakes. The IOR sloughed Serrano off to Sindona as well. By 1971, it still held at least a 3% stake in the pharmaceutical company, but that year, Italy approved the marketing of contraceptive pills, and certain church versus science discrepancies became too obvious to ignore. While Serrano had been producing a contraceptive called Lutelios for some years, because the pill was illegal, they had billed it as a treatment for gynecological disorders. When the pill went public, according to Der Spiegel, Giulio Pacelli finally resigned as president of the Serrano board, citing the Vatican's firm stance against birth control. Fabio Bertarelli, who had taken over from his father as CEO of Serrano, had been fighting to secure ownership of the company for decades. As the Italian government issued warrants for Sindona's arrest in 1974 on charges of fraudulent bankruptcy, the financier fled the country, and Bertarelli scooped up his Serrano shares, gaining a majority stake in the company. After allegedly ordering a mafia hit on the bankruptcy lawyer, tasked with liquidating one of his collapsed banks, Sindona died from cyanide poisoning in an Italian prison. By 1990, the company was supplying half the world's fertility drugs, and Bertarelli was worth $1.5 billion. Upon Fabio's death in 1996, control of the company moved to his son Ernesto, who, 4 years later, listed its shares on the New York Stock Exchange, and in 2007 sold the family's majority stake to Merck for $13.3 billion. Later that year, he commissioned a 318-foot superyacht, the Vava II. The fantastic drug. In the beginning, Pergonal did its job too well. A 1965 issue of Life described it as the fantastic drug that creates quintuplets, as women in California, New York, and Sweden gave birth to sets of mini babies. Urine collectors recruited donors through door-knocking campaigns and made daily drop-offs to plants in Umbria and Benevento. From there, refrigerated trucks transported frozen hormone absorbate to Rome. Soon, Serrano added collection centers in Argentina, the Netherlands, and Spain to the ones in Israel and Italy, with 600 women contributing, which could produce 40,000 ampoules per year. Then, enough to treat the worldwide population of hypopituitary, hypogonadotropic, amenorrheic women. The introduction of IVF, for which multiple mature eggs are ideal, and new protocols prescribing HMG to patients with tubal factor infertility increased demand. By 1985, 2,000 women in the U.S. were prescribed the drug. Soon, patients worldwide required 30 million liters of urine. When HMG became part of a protocol in male factor infertility, the number ballooned to 70 million. Lunenfeld turned his own research to male infertility and founded the International Society for the Study of the Aging Male in 1997. In 1995, despite twice daily pickups from 100,000 urine donors, a shortage of Pergonal caused panicked patients to hoard prescriptions. "I feel like an addict," one woman told the New York Times. 11 years later, Serrano phased out Pergonal, focusing instead on another fertility product, Gonal F, made from hamster ovary cells, and Ferring released Menopur. Citing proprietary information, A Faring spokesperson declined to answer detailed questions, including where urine is collected and whether donors are compensated, and sent a statement which read in part, Faring believes that everyone has the right to build a family and to choose their own path to parenthood. We recognize and work to address diverse family building needs and fertility journeys, including for the LGBTQ+ and single parent by choice communities who use in vitro fertilization to start or grow their families. The website of the Swiss pharmaceutical company Institut Biochimique SA, which produces a similar minotropin, Mariofert, is more transparent about its sourcing. Every day, the urine of pregnant or postmenopausal donors is collected in rural Chinese villages. A representative for IBSA declined to provide information on donor compensation, stating that IBSA decides to cover product topics only in scientific journals. In February, Pope Francis, who last year reaffirmed the Vatican's anti-IVF stance, addressed the General Assembly of the Pontifical Academy for Life, a papal-appointed body responsible for developing Catholic teachings and positions on such topics as abortion, artificial intelligence, and IVF. For those committed to a serious and evangelical renewal of thought, Francis said, it is essential to call into question even settled opinions and assumptions that have not been critically examined. A few weeks later, Tim Kaine, who is Catholic, brought to the State of the Union as his guest Elizabeth Carr, America's first IVF baby, courtesy of Perganal. While the Pope made his address, Lunenfeld and his wife were in the middle of a vacation to celebrate his 97th birthday, beginning with a cruise from Fiji around New Zealand and Australia. From there, he continued to Singapore, where he reunited with old colleagues, including three of Serono's former Singapore-based representatives. At one point during our conversations, I asked him about his own relationship to religion. This is very strange, he says, very strange. He has a hard time defining it. His wife, who's agnostic, calls him religious. He doesn't keep kosher, but he prays every morning. I believe in God because so many things, good things, happen to me. Thinking of the Kinder transport, something must have helped me, somewhere, he says. This is something which is troubling me a lot to understand, and there's no way to understand. No small thing for someone whose life's work has been tracking down answers. Everything was miracles. Thank you. Now here's the Proust questionnaire with an illustration by Ryan McAmis. Alfred Molina, the actor currently starring in Uncle Vanya on Broadway, on his love of vinyl, New York, and not being the worst dad in the world. What is your idea of perfect happiness? A beautiful meal and a glass of wine with my favorite people and lots of laughter ringing around the table. What is the trait you most deplore in yourself? Self-doubt and a reoccurring fear that people would prefer the other Alfred Molina. What is your greatest extravagance? Having my shirts dry cleaned. What do you dislike most about your appearance? How much time do we have? Which words or phrases do you most overuse? Oh, darling, here's something interesting. What is your greatest regret? Waiting so long to move to New York. When and where were you happiest? My first payday as a professional actor, knowing this was the beginning of the rest of my life. And the day my daughter told me I wasn't the worst dad in the world. What is your most treasured possession? My collection of original jazz on vinyl. Where would you like to live? Apart from New York, my mom's village in Italy. What is your most marked characteristic? A tendency to talk too much. What do you most value in your friends? Their love and patience with the above. What is your greatest fear? Dying alone and in pain. Which historical figure do you most identify with? Don't know. I've never met one. What is the trait you most deplore in others? Cruelty and not treating others as equals. What is your favorite journey? The one that takes me home. What do you consider the most overrated virtue? Chastity is just another way to shame and control. On what occasion do you lie, to spare other people's feelings? Which talent would you most like to have, to play the alto saxophone? Who is your favorite hero of fiction? I don't read much fiction, but Winston Smith has stayed with me since my teens. If you could change one thing about yourself, what would it be? I'd be more confident. Who are your favorite writers? Michael Eric Dyson, Christopher Hitchens, Joan Didion. What do you consider your greatest achievement, surviving thus far? If you could choose what to come back as, what would it be? A musician. What is your motto? All the world is theater. Who are your heroes in real life? Immigrants who work hard to give their children every possible opportunity, like my mother did for me. How would you like to die? On a late summer's evening, surrounded by my family, listening to Sarah Vaughan. Too much to ask? And that was the Proust questionnaire with Alfred Molina. members only. Scott Sartiano's private club, Zero Bond, became post-pandemic New York's celeb-friendliest playground, luring the likes of Taylor, Elon, and Mayor Eric Adams. What's the Secret Sauce? By Nate Freeman. Opening photograph by Mark Peterson. And the opening photo shows Scott Sartiano inside his brick-walled abode, or maybe it's his club. Guest pass. Scott Sartiano has long catered to New York's club-going elite. Zero Bond, bare-bricked and impregnable for all, and photographed here, but the richest and most famous, has arguably perfected his formula. On the day before the Super Bowl, Scott Sartiano, owner of the New York City private members club Zero Bond, was an hour late to meet me at a party at another club, Marquee, in another city, Las Vegas. It was 4 p.m, and the sports merch billionaire Michael Rubin was holding his annual party, generally considered one of the most exclusive of the weekend. As security waved Sartiano and his 3+1s through, he apologized for the traffic, which was hardly his fault. It was the biggest weekend in Las Vegas history, with an estimated $600 million added to the economy, helicopters ferrying VIPs down the strip to avoid gridlock, and almost 900 private jets landing at the airport. Even for a career hospitality guy, the full onslaught was a bit much. "All of this," said Sartiano, his arms motioning to the elaborate maze of hallways and checkpoints and wristband allotments and hand stamping. "This isn't really my thing," he said. For a long time, it was. Sartiano has been the invisible hand helping New York City's rich and famous blow off steam in the hours after midnight, a force behind the hottest clubs and clubsterants in post-9/11 Manhattan. Mark Sartiano and business partner Richie Akiva started Butter, the defining celeb-heavy eatery of the aughts, and then the pair and their partners opened One Oak, a nightclub that defined the teens. In 2013, Jay-Z rhymed One Oak with Ended Up Near Broke. Lindsay Lohan was accused of stealing an $11,000 mink coat at One Oak in 2008. Lohan was sued, and per page 6, she settled the case. And while the coat was returned to its owner, Lohan never admitted to wrongdoing. Then she reportedly claimed someone stole part of her $75,000 fur coat at One Oak in 2014. The Safdie brothers set a chunk of the 2012 set Uncut Gems there. The club and its various outposts around the world grossed $250 million in their first decade. Sartiano went solo, and in 2020 opened Zero Bond, taking over a NoHo loft space where celebs can gallivant in a picture-free zone away from the prying eyes of Durmois tipsters. At least 8 private clubs have opened in New York since the pandemic, but Zero Bond has captured a very specific kind of zeitgeist. Art kid cool and a nightclub sleaze and Hollywood glitz and banker bro capital. Celebrity sightings outside the NoHo space fuel FOMO-blinding speculation about what happens inside. Taylor Swift, a rumored member, has come by enough to be considered a Zero Bond resident. Mayor Eric Adams' frequent visits have turned the space into a downtown power center and even more private rows, especially given Adams' close connection to Sartiano, whom Adams named to the board of the Metropolitan Museum of Art shortly after taking office. Sartiano has maintained a sense of removed calm through the club's success, a bemusement that the more hardened party kings lightly mock. When we'd hang at Zero Bond, he often rolled up looking more like a downtown dad in line to get a decaf and stale pastry at La Colombe than, say, the grail, sneaker-rocking, roly-wristed hustler operator one might expect. He's home with his kids every day from 6 to 8 p.m. He has two small dogs that he walks himself. He actually kind of hates going to the club. I felt like an actor that was miscast for a long time. I looked around like, who are these people? What am I doing? Why am I here? Sartiano said, I don't like being in a nightclub, hanging out with someone because they buy a bunch of bottles of champagne, drinking, getting drunk. That's lame. As we cleared the last of several security checkpoints in Vegas, there was Marquee, a dance floor that gave way to golden-hued banquettes that gave way to a white-canopied pleasure dome dotted with palm trees hovering 17 stories above the Mojave Desert. Zach Bia was in the DJ booth. Josh Kushner, the founder of Thrive Capital and brother of former Trump advisor, son-in-law Jared Kushner, slapped Sartiano on the back as he entered. Kushner was with Mikey Hess, heir to the International Hess Oil and Chemical Corporation. They stepped aside as Queen Latifah walked by. After getting briefly separated from Sartiano and his crew due to a barrage of aspiring schmoozers cutting between us, I did a spin around one section of the party to take in the scene. When I returned, Sartiano shook his head. You just missed Tom, Sartiano said, meaning Tom Brady, a close friend. Sartiano walked past the model Winnie Harlow to the last cabana, where Ruben and entrepreneur Gary Vaynerchuk were watching as Ice Spice came on stage for a performance. Justin Bieber, shirtless, bounced over and started yelling in our general direction to no one in particular. It's MFing Ice Spice! Are you into this? His wife, Hailey Bieber, stood a few feet behind with a look of utter serenity as Kendall Jenner poured herself a glass of her own brand of tequila. Surely Sartiano had to love this. These were his people, his old friends. Soon he was talking to Kim Kardashian. He said he's known her forever. She was sitting on a couch in the back of the cabana with her sister Courtney. He was especially happy to see Lala Anthony. The actor Glenn Powell told Sartiano that he had just relocated to Tribeca and was itching to join Zero Bond. I felt like I've heard your name like 1,000 times since I moved there, Powell told him. Standing behind Bieber was Akiva, Sartiano's former partner. The pair's 2014 split led to a lawsuit, an alleged secret buyout, and millions that were owed. They didn't speak or look at each other. Come on, let's go back to the win, Sartiano said after an hour. It took 45 minutes to travel the 1.6 miles from the Cosmopolitan, home to Marquee, to the poshest casino in Las Vegas, and another 10 minutes to walk past the floor, beyond the cage, around the faux Italian cafe to the villas, where a hotel executive pressed a key card to a screen. Sartiano walked into what once was the private mansion of the fallen gaming titan Steve Wynn, who opened the resort that bears his name and gave himself a duplex villa right next to the 18th hole of his golf course. Wynn was one of the most insatiable art collectors of the last 50 years, and he had once installed Picassos and a Lichtenstein in the space. The villa had been sitting empty and unused since Wynn resigned from Wynn Resorts amid sexual misconduct allegations that he denied and a lawsuit filed by stakeholders in 2018. Sartiano was in the middle of turning it into Zero Bond's second location. For those who aren't members, there will also be a second edition of the owner's namesake Soho Italian joint Sartiano's, if you can get a reservation. He took me through the space. pointing at walls, dreaming up how Zero Bond would look, a billiards room, private gaming, a mini nightclub, fine dining, plenty of rooms for schmoozing and deal-making. Then we walked outside, and the villa glowed golden against the backdrop of the nearly 5,000-room resort. It was a brief moment of calm in the city that was temporarily the frothy center of the sports and entertainment universe. We watched as a 3-story waterfall built on limestone imported from Turkey spilled 500,000 gallons of water into a fake lake in the middle of arid Nevada. The Sphere, James Dolan's $2 billion concert venue, and digital billboard, flashed a giant smiley face upon the strip, then winked. Sartiano told me he had a goal of convincing Dolan to program something special the night he opens in Vegas, a giant meatball. In the nearly 4 years since Zero Bond opened its first location in a former Brooks Brothers factory at the corner of Bond Street and Broadway, it's become the most buzzed about and polarizing members club in a city that is suddenly full of them. For years, the main members of the club in town, was Soho House, which has essentially gone the way of the skinny jean. But then the Manhattan jet set emerged from COVID richer and maybe a little more germophobic than it had been pre-pandemic. Certainly it was allergic to the newly ascendant stalkergrams and ever bolder blind item accounts running rampant on social media. Most private members' clubs ban pictures of any kind inside the premises. Zero Bond is perhaps the most discreet of all, though of course a few details get out. Elon Musk reportedly hosted his Met Gala party there in 2021. According to Page Six, Google co-founder Sergey Brin's wife rented it out to throw a Studio 54-themed party when Georgina Bloomberg and Shawn Mendes danced to DJ Kygo and Diplo. Britney Spears got sushi with J Balvin and Maluma. Drake would reportedly spend days recording at a makeshift studio there. Gigi Hadid and Bradley Cooper were spotted by the exit after midnight. Bill Clinton stopped by. Pete Davidson and Kim Kardashian had their second date at Zero Bond. In 2022, the club hosted a Met Gala after party with Olivia Rodrigo, Addison Rae, Kaia Gerber, and Austin Butler, all in attendance. That was topped by the 2023 Met Gala Zero Bond party hosted by Stella McCartney and Baz Luhrmann. Leo and Gigi, Giselle and J-Lo, Irina Shayk in sweatpants, Jared Leto in the cat head. Photos of the interior almost never leak. Swift was captured in grainy shots taken by members at Casa Cipriani, a rival private club in a Beaux-Arts building on the southern tip of Manhattan. And rumor has it, she promptly severed her membership and the picture takers were banned. Not a single snap of Swift inside Zero Bond has surfaced, though. As chronicled by the tabloids, she's really logged her hours. She reportedly showed up with former flame Maddie Healy and friends such as Zoe Kravitz, Margaret Qualley, and Jack Antonoff in May 2023, and again with longtime collaborator Ed Sheeran in August. There was a girls' night with Blake Lively in September. And then she went once again after her boyfriend Travis Kelce's game at MetLife Stadium, though it's unclear if Kelce joined her at Zero Bond after beating the Jets on their home turf. Each time I, a non-member, arrived at Zero Bond, the cheery woman at the entrance desk checked my name and ID and pushed a button that opens the elevator, which goes straight to a fifth-floor loft space that looks like that dream downtown apartment that 20-somethings unrealistically have in mid-aughts movie sets in New York City. The beamed ceilings are enormous. The walls of 1870s red brick are slashed through by accent marks of black marble, and the seats are arranged in low clusters with lights fixed at a sexy dim. One of the few times the public's been brought inside Zero Bond, it was actually appointment viewing. In the closing scenes of the finale of Succession, Kieran Culkin's Roman Roy sits down and orders a martini in a chic-looking lounge, light streaming in, hint of a smile on his face despite it all. How perfect is it that the vanquished plutocrat's ultimate fate brings him to the Jones Bar on the fourth floor of Zero Bond? That's one reason celebrities like it. The people that are there on a daily basis, you never read about what they eat, who they're with, Sartiano told me. That's something I'm very proud of. It takes me back to the late 90s, when people could do whatever they want. And they'll never do whatever they want again like that, because they're too nervous. He was sitting at Sartiano's, the Italian restaurant he opened last year in the Mercer Hotel. It replaced the Jean-Georges Van Gerichten joint that had been there for decades. The hotel takes that extra step toward discretion. Only long-term residents and guests can enter the lobby, and shrubbery prevents Soho tourists from peering in. Now it has a gigantic neon sign flashing Sartiano's last name at those walking on Prince Street. I'm not a total douchebag, even though it seems like a total douchebag move to have the neon lights and the name on a plate and the name on the menu. It's like name everywhere, he said, but I genuinely thought it'd be a cool name for a restaurant. Next, photos, super friends. Zero Bond's status as Mayor Eric Adams' de facto back room added to its public profile early on, helping to attract the likes of Kim Kardashian. 2023 Met Gala after partiers such as Aubrey Plaza, Jared Leto and Baz Luhrmann, and Gigi Hadid, a NoHo neighbor, with Tan France. Speaking to the clients he's brought into his establishments makes it seem like Sartiano is a perpetual cheer machine, a burst of relative sobriety in the bender that is the clubbing business. When you're at one of his spots, it may look and feel easy, but I know the work he puts in to make it all happen, Brady said in an email a few days after I missed him at Ruben's party. Simon Huck, the Kardashians' approved PR spin master, said that Sartiano's demeanor distinguishes him from the usual macho, tough guy sheen of his peers. Scott is more of a listener than a talker, and he has a very, I'm going to say, soft temperament, but that's not the right word, Huck said. He's got such a nice temperament. It's like he's the most unsuspecting hospitality nightlife entrepreneur, right? But Sartiano is also shrewd and clearly ambitious, with a ripple of ruthlessness beneath the goofball smile. Zero Bond has elevated him into a new Manhattan echelon, a tax bracket above running a place where kids get zooted and dance to their little songs. Plenty of bankers have bought bottle service off Sartiano over the years, but now Goldman Sachs hitters can use their Zero Bond memberships to woo clients while pouring from sticker shock bottles. There are various little nooks separated by partitions to give the extra special members extra privacy in the private club. The Middle Eastern sovereign wealth community, those guys love Zero Bond. It's common to have members book a place like the Baccarat Room, accessed via fingerprint scanner to ceremoniously sign a big deal. During his 2021 campaign, now New York Mayor Eric Adams would sometimes appear at the club multiple nights in a row. On one Saturday, he gave an impromptu stump speech while Paris Hilton was celebrating her engagement to Carter Room, and then proceeded to chat with Ali bin Ahmed Al-Khawri, the Qatari finance minister, whose government has purchased the Plaza Hotel and several luxury hotels in London. In the weeks that followed the election, The mayor-elect was at zero bond so much that the New York Times called the members club Adams' informal transition headquarters. When it came time to pick an election night after party, Adams and crew decamped to zero bond. Forrest Whitaker and Eric Schmidt, the ex-CEO of Google, showed up. Sartiano has benefited immensely from his relationship with Adams. His 2022 appointment to the Metropolitan Museum of Art Board put him in one of the most coveted positions in American philanthropy. Adams sits ex officio on the museum's board and thus must have a representative among the trustees to communicate with his office. The mayor was looking for a New Yorker who could bring a new outlook, as well as a wealth of energy and passion to the role, a City Hall spokesperson said. But Sartiano is the first to admit that he has a slim experience in the museum world, and an investigation by local website Hellgate revealed that some of the paperwork related to his appointment contained basic errors. There was a miscommunication on the draft of the cover letter, but I stand by the content in the letter and application, Sartiano later said by email. The outlet also pointed out that Sartiano, who bought a $3.5 million loft a block away from zero bond in 2022, is one of the many NoHo dwellers to benefit from Adams' vetoing of a zoning bill that would have required non-artist buyers in the neighborhood to pay hefty fees. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.